Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degrees boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Now, I've taken it upon myself recently to have a boiled egg in the morning. I'm actually having two. I don't know why. I suppose it's winter and I thought I'd do that. But now the boiled egg experience is so easy with the cooker. You just walk over, you fill the pan up with 100 degree boiling hot water, stick it on the stove. 6 minutes I cooked mine for. Perfectly cooked eggs in 6 minutes, and then absolutely delicious. Obviously, you can still do your brews, you can do your veg, you can do your pasta. You can use it for everything. Fantastic bit of kit if you can afford one. I really recommend them. Go to cooker.co.uk to find out more details. Look at all the different styles. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. We're back talking about drugs today. Today, I'm curious how taking cannabis can help seriously ill children. And obviously, there's a follow-up question. Why is it still so hard for them to get it? The UK only has two paediatric consultants prescribing, with no sign of the NHS prescribing in the near future. Now, I feel my frustration here is we don't even seem to be having a conversation about it, like all the things to do with drugs. And I fear the politicians feel the public are so anti-drugs that it's not even worth their time. Today, I'm talking to Matt Hughes, who campaigns to raise awareness of the current barriers and lack of support from government and stigma within the NHS with regards to cannabis as a medicine. Matt had listened to my podcast on drug reform and he contacted me and he thought it'd be a good idea to discuss more about medical uses on this podcast. I'll tell you what, let's meet him. He can describe it all much better than me. Here's Matt. Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for being on the podcast today. I think the first thing we need to do is establish how you're on it. You basically heard one of my podcasts, didn't you?
I did with Professor Nutt.
Yeah,
who we know very well. So I had a listen to that, which was brilliant. And I reached out to you.
It's frustrating, isn't it, with Professor Nutt, what he says, and the fact that we are for anyone who doesn't know, by the way, Professor Nutt it was a czar, the drug czar employed by the Labour government a few. I don't know how long ago it was, 15 years ago, maybe further. And he decided that drugs should be like legalized, basically, or definitely be able to use in medical circumstances for things like psilocybin, LSD, cannabis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then he was sacked for coming up with this suggestion, even though he'd done all the research and sort of campaigned ever since then to try and try and get this stuff so we can actually use it in medicine. And he's a good guy. And your concerns are cannabis, really, aren't they?
Yes, it's the prescription. So 2018 saw the change in law through campaigning of my very good friend and colleague, Hannah Deacon. If I just talk about her campaign very quickly, her son, Alfie, suffers. Well, he has PCDH19, which is a genetic disorder or mutation, and that causes his epilepsy. And Elfie was suffering severe seizures, life-threatening seizures, which were uncontrollable. The only medication which seemed to help was very, very high-dose steroids, which the clinician said would eventually kill him anyway. With the NHS unable to help, Hannah went to Holland to try cannabis. And she was prescribed cannabis over there, and it really helped him. He's seizure-free for, I can't remember exactly the details now, several months. And then she returned to the UK and began her campaigns for that access here. So at that time, cannabis was a Schedule 1 medicine. Under Schedule 1, that means it has no therapeutic value, and there's no research unless you have a Schedule 1 license. And through her campaigning and huge media support and public support, long story short, Alfie was given a license by Theresa May to use. So it's the first Schedule 1 license for a patient in the UK. And then a few months later, in November 2018, the law was changed to allow specialist clinicians to prescribe cannabis, which we all thought was a major breakthrough. So finally, our children can access cannabis. Going back to my own story, my son, Charlie, at 10 weeks old, so he's our first child. At 10 weeks old, he was diagnosed with a form of epilepsy called infantile spasms. And it was a huge shock to us. Again, we're just getting used to parenthood and everything that's new to you. To then deal with a severe form of epilepsy was just, it's rather traumatic. And initially he responded really, really well to pharmaceuticals. So again, it was steroids and another drug called Vigabatrin. And he was seizure-free for 3 months and developing, or appeared to be developing, in the normal way. And then the steroids are very high dose. So here's a baby, but the steroids were at a dosage that an 18-year-old would use. And that was having a major impact on his liver and his kidneys, and he wouldn't be able to use that long-term. In fact, he bloated. His whole body was completely blown up. It was like a balloon blessing. And, so we had to wean off that. And upon weaning, he relapsed and the seizures returned immediately. And it's from that point, we could not gain control again. We tried so many different anti-epileptics. They came with their own side effects. They were used in a combination. So he's on up to 4 anti-epileptics at the same time and still suffering up to 120 seizures per day. No quality of life. I can remember my wife going to a nursery, and she just phoned me up and broke down in tears and just said, I can't do this, because he just wasn't doing anything. He just laid there. If he wasn't having seizures. And everyone starts looking at her as well and just, oh, what's wrong with your child? And she felt so isolated and alone. And, we had no other friends who had a child in this situation who had these disabilities. So you do feel really, really isolated and completely on your own. And, the NHS couldn't do anything. These clinicians saying that we tried everything. We had the ketogenic diet, that didn't help. And it was an absolute nightmare as well, because everything has to be formulated and measured so precisely. And he hated it as well. It's very greasy, oily diet. And we also went down the brain surgery route as well, to see if that was an option. It wasn't, sadly, for Charlie, but it's something we considered. With all options that, exhausted, I then started researching myself. And the more researching I'd done, looking for therapies in Australia, in the US, Canada, etc., cannabis kept cropping up as a potential for seizure control. And at first, I didn't really believe it. You watch some YouTube clips and things like that, and I was like, no, this can't be a thing. But the more research I'd done, I was like, okay, there is something in this. There is clinical studies in this, and there are other children benefiting from cannabis elsewhere in the world. And at that time, Hannah had her campaign going for Elfie. So I reached out to her and started talking more about cannabis and linked to Professor Mike Barnes and had a chat with him. And then post change of the law, I joined Hannah with Endow Pain and 19 other families, campaigning for wider NHS access. So after the law changed, everyone presumed this would be population-wide access to cannabis on the NHS. Sadly, NICE guidance then kicked in, and the British Paediatric Neurology Association brought out their guidance. And they basically prevented they didn't want cannabis to be available, basically.
Why? And
it really put clinicians off. I think stigma. I think, cannabis has been this Schedule 1 drug that had no therapeutic value. Then all of a sudden this child come along and changed the law, and now all of a sudden you've got this new medication. And there's no training on the endocannabinoid system, which cannabis binds to, the receptors, the phytocannabinoids, and the receptors are in our body. So for anyone that doesn't know, our endocannabinoid system reproduce our own endocannabinoids, very similar to what's found in the cannabis plant. And they work on receptors within our body, within our brain, all our vital organs. And it's an essential part of our nervous system. It's what keeps our body in what's called homeostasis. So it's a major player within our body in keeping us alive and well and, active and healthy. And cannabis plays a role in that. It binds with those same receptors. That's why cannabis is known to help so many different elements and symptoms and conditions. That isn't taught in medical schools. There's very few in the UK that teach that. So clinicians have grown up throughout their whole life, through school, through medical school, as cannabis being this illicit drug that is harmful. Cannabis can cause mental health issues. We know that. And there are there are studies to show that psychosis and schizophrenia are an issue in a very small minority. I think it's 1 in 44,000. So there are risks, but we know through other data that it's very, very safe under clinical guidance. But it's that.
So where are you now? Have you got access to cannabis now?
Yeah, so in May 2019, Charlie was privately prescribed cannabis. And after several months, we saw an 85% reduction in seizures.
Wow.
And I'll never forget, we had a consultation with our NHS pediatric consultant. And he had never seen Charlie without having seizures. And for that whole hour, Charlie was seizure-free. He was interacting, wow. Really good eye response, pulling his lanyard and smiling, giggling, bouncing up and down in his bed. And his consultant, just this smile just came out on his face, and he just went, wow, this is
lovely.
Never seen how this does before.
How does Charlie take it?
Oil. It's just sublingual. So it's just in the syringe, and it's an oil, and yeah. Simple as
so
that.
So how does he take it? In a drink or something? Or
no, it's just it's in a syringe. So he just takes it as the raw oil.
Can he handle the taste?
Yeah, he seems fine with it. Some children don't like it, and you could mix it with a yogurt or something fatty to help aid bioavailability. But yeah, he has no issues with it.
All right, let me...
But yeah, we then had... Sorry.
I was just going to say, let's go back through the story a bit. So how does it feel, first of all, to be a parent when you suddenly realize your child is having seizures? What does that actually feel like? I mean, it must be horrific to know this is something which is ongoing and watching a small child, baby, suffer.
Yeah, I can't really put into words how it feels. I think looking back, I just went into this numb state. I don't know. I had so many different emotions, but I had to be strong for my wife and for Charlie. But yeah, you just go through, I think, every emotion going. You know, I had moments on my own where I just completely broke down. And
yeah,
you just changes your life because you look to the future and, you know, I'm never going to be able to go to the pub with my son. And I think every man with a son, it's almost, you know, I'm going to take them to the football or to the rugby. And I'm going to go to the pub and have a drink with them. And when they first get married, you know, I'm going to stitch them up and get them completely drunk and things like that. It's, you know, none of that's going to happen for us. And it's still something I find really hard to kind of
You'll still have amazingly beautiful times.
Yes, we do.
I just feel so sorry for all three of you, actually, because it must be, you know, when any of my children have been ill, that it just breaks your heart, even when it's just a cold or something. Like, oh no, they're suffering, and as a parent, you can't. It's very hard to stand and watch. You want to take the suffering away, don't you? And you would rather yourself suffer rather than the child suffer.
Yeah, so it must exactly
be
that.
Yeah, it must be. Must be very hard. What is an epileptic fit? What is actually happening? Do they know? Do you know?
Yeah, it's overexcited neurons in the brain. That is basically what epilepsy is. So our neurons are very arithmetic, and yeah, when they get overexcited and start firing, that's when seizures happen. So basically, the communication into the body doesn't get there; it stays in the brain, and that's when an epileptic seizure happens. And obviously, the more serious they get, you then can go into what's called epileptic status. You can stop breathing, your body goes into full spasm. And there's various different types of seizures, but they're all very serious. There's not one that's any less serious than another. So that's ultimately why epilepsy is.
Interesting that Theresa May was the one who decided to allow it for medical purposes, being that her husband is an investor or one of the people who sells the
cannabis, right? Capital One, who are an investor of GW Pharma. It's not him personally, but the organization who was a director.
Yeah, he's not pulling out, is he? Of it, yeah. He's not saying, "Oh, we can't go anywhere near that. I'm resigning because you're dealing." I mean, I think people don't realize. I've done a lot of on this. We're a massive supplier of cannabis for medical purposes around the world, aren't we? We export massive of it.
Yeah, so GW Pharma, who were recently brought out by Jazz Pharmaceuticals in Ireland, they produce Sativex and Epidiolex. So Sativex is a THC CBD spray used for MS, and Epidiolex is a CBD isolate, which has had clinical trials to show good, well, reasonable efficacy in children with epilepsy. They're both licensed products, and yes, we export around the world, predominantly US. But we do know that was a recent Freedom of Information request that in the UK there's only been 201 prescriptions for Epidiolex for children, because it's an orphan drug. It's on an orphan license, which means it's only available for two syndromes of epilepsy, which is E and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So for the vast majority of children, it's not actually available. They can only prescribe it under that licensing. Being it's a CBD isolate as well, data is beginning to show that it's not as effective as a whole plant cannabis. Now, whole plant cannabis is CBD, THC, and the other phytocannabinoids that are contained within cannabis and the terpenes. So it's the full extract from the cannabis plant rather than everything stripped out and you're left with one molecule.
What's your job, Matt?
IT. I'm from an IT tech background. Right.
But you seem to know a lot now, obviously, about cannabis. So it's funny because you confused me a bit. I must admit, with the last answer to the question, there's a few things that I do know. The difference between THC and CBD. CBD is the bit which we're allowed to take over here. The THC is the bit which gets you high, isn't it? I do know this because I've spoken to various people on this podcast that. Even though CBD is very useful for people, some people really need the THC bit of it as well. And that's basically what you're saying, isn't it? That Charlie needs the THC bit as well.
Yeah, it's not just the THC, it's the other phytonutrients. So CBDV is another anti-seizure compound within cannabis. So it's a combination of these phytocannabinoids that help. But yeah, higher THC is a bit more beneficial in some children. So, not everyone, but...
So how did you feel then when you finally, when Theresa May, what year was it that she decided that we were allowed to start prescribing?
So it's in June 2018, she allowed Elfi a license, and it is November 2018 that Savage Avid changed the law. He is Home Secretary at that time.
To what's the law now then? Anyone?
So the law is cannabis can be prescribed for any condition, but only under a specialist condition.
So for children and adults?
Yeah, children and adults, yeah.
So we've, okay. So how, first of all, how do you feel now that is moved in that direction? That must feel pretty amazing, because I do a lot of stuff on drug reform and like podcasts, and just seems to me that we're just stuck in a bit of a stalemate at the moment. So it must have been amazing when they said, you know, people can start using cannabis on prescription.
Yeah, for us, I don't think it's so much it was cannabis. For us, it was there was another option. We'd exhausted everything. This isn't, we're not talking about families that this is the first drug that they've tried. We've been through absolutely everything. We've exhausted every drug available on the NHS. So we're not talking about, you know, this is the last resort. And to have that as an option, that there's evidence out there to show it's very therapeutic, it's safe. Very little side effects. That brings hope. You know, that could bring my child back. That's the future for us. So it was the thing for us. It's, there's another medicine now available to us. Except it's just not available. It's privately available. So the current situation is the UK has two private prescribing clinicians for whole plant extracts or unlicensed medicines, but they have their books closed. So there's approximately 60 to 80 children prescribed privately. The vast majority are doing very, very well, but the NHS has closed down completely. There are free NHS prescriptions, funded prescriptions for whole plant extracts, unlicensed cannabis, Hannah's or Alfi being one of them, but it's been closed doors to anyone else. And it's the British Paediatric...
What does book close mean? The private people are saying no more patients?
Taking on any more patients, no. So that's ultimately meaning... There are only so many patients that can take on as individuals. Both part-time. But it's the British Paediatric Neurology Association. So we have a major problem in the UK with paediatric consultants coming forward. So just as a... an outline. So in the UK at the moment, there is 1.8 million people using cannabis for medical purposes through the illicit market. There are 20,000 patients prescribed privately, and there are 100 clinicians prescribing cannabis privately as well. So there's around 15 to 20 private cannabis clinics now available in the UK. There's various different independent and independent pharmacies dispensing cannabis medicines. But this is all happening within the private sector. So if you're lucky enough to be able to afford a private prescription and the costs, so for us, it's £600 a month. It used to be thousands in the early days. As more people come in, the costs have come down. But we're in a very fortunate position. We've got someone that's helping us fund that. For many others, it's unattainable, especially for parents that are on carers' allowance, unable to work because their children are still seizing every day. That's unattainable. They can't access that.
Hold on. Why is it £600 a month?
It's the cost. It's the cost of consultation.
But there's no way you can get it for a lot. But you can get it cheaper than that, surely, on the net or from a bloke down the pub.
Well, this is the problem. This is why families are now turning to a bloke down the pub. But why should a family be approaching some guy in a pub who has no knowledge of epilepsy? These are severely chronically ill children. And it has to be highlighted that THC is a pro-convulsant as well. So if you get the wrong dosage, you could potentially be causing your child more harm. Now, on the illicit market, how do you know what you're getting? You know, under prescription, you know how the dosage is. You know how many milligrams of THC you're administering. You know how much CBD, etc. From your guy down the pub, you have no idea what you're giving your child. And this is what families are coming to us for. I'm sorry, just as a sideline, I run an organisation called MedCan Support. We now support over 600 families in that position where they can't access cannabis through the private sector, and they're having to go to CBD companies or to your guy down the pub to access cannabis. And in our eyes, that's completely wrong. When the law has changed, and these families should be under clinical guidance within the NHS, within the private sector.
I know people who are growing it themselves, and one person was putting other people at risk because everyone's aware they're growing it in the house and it's illegal. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that everyone has to go, okay, we all know it helps you. So we're having to all sort of just go along with it, realizing that everybody's complicit because everybody knows it's being grown in the premises. But it's ridiculous. It's a bloody plant. Let me just go back one stage, though. Where is the £600 going? It's a plant, right? So who's getting this money, the £600? It can't cost that much money to take the plant and then turn it into the oil. It cannot cost £600 a month.
There is a supply chain behind this because it's a pharmaceutical route. So at the moment, every cannabis medicine is imported into the UK. We don't, other than GW Pharma, who produce isolate cannabis within the NHS, there's no one producing cannabis as a whole plant extract in the UK. So everything has to be imported from Australia, Canada, and Israel. They're the predominant countries importing. So you have that supply chain, and obviously everyone has to make their costs as it goes through the supply chain. You have the clinic, you have the pharmacy, you have the distributor. But also growing cannabis as a pharmaceutical, you have regulations you have to abide by. You have GMP to build a facility that meets GMP standards. So you know that your product is safe. It all costs money. So it's very, very different to growing.
Matt, I know that, but it doesn't cost £600. I'm sorry. It's really annoyed me that, because there's at the end of the chain is children, and you have now, as well as finding your payments for mortgage and your payments for your bills, your everything else, your food and your facilities.
Cost of living.
What's the word I'm looking
for? Heating, everything.
Exactly, heating, all that. And suddenly now you've got to find £600 on top, and you have to find that comes first. And it's like, I could be wrong, but I just don't believe it costs £600 to make. So, obviously it doesn't. There's a profit on it, but I mean, I just find that horrible.
Yeah, with children, genuinely, they tend to, with refractory epilepsy, they tend to require much higher doses than what you'd give someone with anxiety or pain. So that is part of the problem. But again, this is why we're fighting for NHS access. it should be available on the NHS, and then it's free to us. You know, we have so many other pharmaceutical medicines that are prescribed, which cost a huge amount of money. But that's not an issue because it's on the NHS.
Yeah. I suppose utilities was the word I was looking for, by the way. So I suppose all these people who are taking it illegally or growing it, buying it, taking it illegally without a prescription, are the authorities, the police and everything, are they starting to turn a blind eye to it now? Are they just sort of going, oh, let these guys
get
on with it?
Yeah, I think generally they are starting to turn a blind eye. There is an organisation called CanCard, based in the UK. A friend of mine, Carly, set that up. And that is for those that are growing, that are going to the guy in the pub, but for medical reasons. So there's a card, it's called CanCard, like a credit card that you can carry with you. And the concept behind that is that if a GP says that you have a condition, say anxiety, or you're suffering chronic pain, because you can't access that private prescription and because it's not available in the NHS, that if you are stopped by the police, that you can show them the CanCard. Now, this isn't a government initiative. It's not legally recognised. But CanCard are working with police commissioners. And generally around, especially Norfolk, where I'm from, they are recognising that there are patients out there that just can't access this medicine in the legal route. And so they're going to go to the illicit means. So it's not punishing patients. And this card kind of identifies them as patients, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I suppose going back to Professor Nutt, where this conversation started, the frustrating thing is cannabis seems to be, listeners, I'm going to use this word loosely, it seems to be a little bit of a miracle drug. It seems to have quite a lot of uses, yet the reality is we're not doing much research on it, if any. And so we don't really know. So you might be taking it and it might not be doing you anything or maybe even doing you maybe some harm, and other people might be taking it and it's really helping them out. It's frustrating. And as you say, there's so many different strains of the stuff. It would be much better if we could spend time to do some proper research. It clearly works. I met a woman in a pub once, right? And by the way, I've got no evidence to back this up apart from she was sitting there. So I haven't got her medical records or anything, but she was sitting there with an oil. This has got to be 15 years ago to 18 years ago or something. She's sitting there and she's got this oil and she's putting it in her mouth and she was just drinking soft drinks. And I said, "What are you doing?" She goes, "Oh, I'm taking cannabis oil." And I said, "Is that legal?" She goes, "Yeah, but I mean, look." And she goes, she got a picture out and she said on her phone, she got a thing out and she went, "This was my brain when it had brain tumor, and this is it now from cannabis oil." Now, listeners, I'm not saying it cures cancer, but this woman was saying it's been massive for her and really helped. I thought that's absolute nonsense. My brother had died of cancer and everything else. I went home and started researching it, and there's a lot of people who are saying cannabis can help. But by the way, cannabis can also give you cancer if you smoke enough of it. So, you know, be careful of that. But, so we don't really know what it's doing for you, do you? You must have heard of examples of that constantly, Matt.
Yeah, there's, so with Big Cancer Support, we're getting more and more families with children with end-of-life cancers, particularly, funny enough, brain tumours. Recently, I just done a webinar with C4T, who are based in Canada. They're doing clinical trials in cannabis in pediatric cancers and epilepsy. And clinicians over there and here in the UK, there was a survey to show here in the UK, so it's an NHS pediatric oncologist that we were chatting to, and a survey shows that 30% of families with children with end-of-life cancers are using cannabis here in the UK. And it's not necessarily to fight the tumour, but it's that quality of life. And rather using the opiates and, you know, these really powerful painkillers, it's using cannabis instead. And cannabis has shown to be a very good add-on therapy. Now, as you say, it's not a cure-all. Cannabis in some forms of cancer can promote the cancer, can make it worse. So I completely agree. We do need more evidence, clinical evidence, more trials. But this has been the problem with Schedule 1. So cannabis is still a Schedule 1 drug. And to even start researching cannabis, you need a Schedule 1 license. And this all costs money and it's all very complex and Home Office is involved, etc. So I do feel government can play a role in helping support research. I know NIHR have funding available, but at the moment, cannabis is only available through imports. So we need a UK domestic supply of cannabis. Now, there are producers with R&D licenses growing in the UK, but it's such a complicated and there's so much politics involved and red tape, and it's an absolute nightmare and it costs an absolute fortune.
Schedule one, is that the war on drugs that we hear so much about? Is that what that means?
Well, you've got different schedulings, but yeah, schedule one basically means the drug has no therapeutic value. So it's harmful and dangerous, and cannabis still sits in that category. When it's prescribed, it's a schedule two.
So let's have a little few minutes on what it actually does. I did a podcast about CBD oil years ago on here, and I got sent some. It was strong stuff, actually. I think it was up to 40%, and I think I got 40, 30, and 20% or something. I was taking it, and I was having real problems with insomnia at the time, and I took it. And I'd be honest with you now, I've got some here still, and I take it every now and then, but hardly ever. But I took it for about a week, and listener, I'm not saying this is going to do it for you, but it completely cleared up my insomnia. I just slept like a, I'm going to say baby, but babies wake up all night, don't they? Some of them do anyway, some of mine do. But I just slept so well and so deeply. It just sort of calmed me down, and it seemed to have this great impact on me where I just sort of mellowed out and managed to sleep. And you know, I've now spent ages, I read lots of Zen and Stoicism and the Stoics, and I read all that sort of stuff, and so I meditate a lot, so I managed to calm myself down. But at the time, I had no knowledge of any of this, and it seemed to work for me. Is there something in what I'm saying there? Is that what happens to you? You sort of, it sort of calms your body down and sort of gives your body a bit of a rest.
Yeah, CBD interacts with receptors are in the body. Again, this is going back to the endocannabinoid system. So phytocannabinoids found in the cannabis plant and terpenes interact with our endocannabinoid system. Now, there is a theory. There is more science beginning to prove it, but it's what's called the entourage effect. So it's the phytocannabinoids working together with terpenes, which are found in vegetables and many other herbs and fruits and all sorts that we consume. These work in homeostasis and keep our body balanced. So when your body's balanced, you get really good sleep. So, you know, we all have very high stresses in modern life, and cannabis is almost like that nutrition. It brings us almost like vitamin C. You know, when you're low in your vitamins, you need to supplement with that. But there are also conditions where our endocannabinoid system isn't functioning right. So there was a study in the US that showed children, I think it's 60% of the cohort, their endocannabinoid system wasn't functioning. And so the phytocannabinoids of cannabis were replacing the endocannabinoids we produce ourselves. So that's why cannabis is so effective in so many different areas. But again, we need more research to understand the endocannabinoid system, which was only found in the 1990s. So it's a very newly discovered system.
What is the system then? If you were my biology teacher, how would you describe that system to me? I know some of my systems, but what is this one? How does it work? What does it do? What does it look like?
I would describe it. It's a part of our central nervous system. It's really fundamental to that. And I would describe it as an overarching system which interacts with all our other body systems, our respiratory system, women with their wounds, they have lots of receptors. It's involved in so many other systems within our body. So it just keeps the whole body in that homeostasis.
So it's part of the nervous system?
Yep.
Right, okay. So when I did the psilocybin, it really felt like when I was talking to Professor David Nutt, it really felt like that my brain was sort of rewiring itself a bit. That's what it genuinely felt like. And he seemed to agree with me that's what their findings were. So if you're taking cannabis, is it in a way resetting that system? Is it helping it? Is it nurturing?
Say resetting. So especially in epilepsy, it helps reduce the neurons. So it brings homeostasis to the brain. So again, epilepsy is overexcited neurons. it brings that homeostasis, it brings that balance back. So the chemical interactions that are happening in the brain causing the neurons to fire, it's pulling that back. So GABA is, which you mentioned with Professor Nutt, yeah. GABA plays a fundamental role in bringing balance to the brain, especially in epilepsy. So a lot of a number of pharmaceutical drugs increase GABA in the brain. So there's a protein yeah. which breaks that down. Cannabis interacts in the same way. There's some phytocannabinoids which increase GABA. So,
Apart from on social media, everybody I talk to about drug reform, and I mean literally everybody, goes, yeah, I think it's a good idea, especially for medical purposes. You never meet anyone who goes, no, I think it's a really bad idea to give ill children drugs that might help them. That no one says that. And obviously people are really starting to understand that psychedelics are good for depression and mm-hmm. And things. And there are, obviously there's still a lot of bad thoughts on ketamine, even though that's, you know, that's quite useful for them, and MDMA, you know, but the sort of LSD and the psilocybin people seem to be really keen on. And then cannabis, you can't find anyone out there who doesn't think for medical purposes it's not a good idea.
Other than neurologists. Everyone else seems to be on board, yeah.
I'm saying, do you find people, when you go out and talk about it, is there pushback? Are you saying there's pushback from neurologists then?
Yeah, from the general public, everyone's in full support. I've never met anyone that's sitting there saying, oh, you're doing your child harm, especially when you're given the backstory. We have tried absolutely everything. Neurologists, there is concerns over THC in the developing brain. Now, my argument, again, is that harm reduction approach. Now, we don't know everything about cannabis, but we have enough evidence to show that it's safe. And given the scenario as well, what's better, to give a child THC or to have 120 seizures that we know are life-threatening? So yeah. We don't know the full story long-term, but it's that balance. So for us as parents, you know, Charlie's on anti-epileptics, one of which he's addicted to. It's a benzodiazepine. He's been on, you know, we're never going to be able to probably wean off that. He's on another drug which is going to cause him tunnel vision long term. So we have to weigh up these side effects and the pros and cons and actually look at the main impact of seizures, the quality of life. You know, it's such a complicated subject, but to just turn a blind eye to cannabis and for neurologists to turn their back and say, well, actually, I'd rather you go down to the pub and see a guy about yeah. using cannabis. In my mind, they should be prescribing unlicensed cannabis medicines, which we know are safe, and have that child under their care, not turn your back on them and force them to go down to the guy at the pub. That's wrong.
Yeah, it must be so hard for you as a parent. Also, you were saying at the beginning of the podcast about, you know, it can bring on depression, and I also think psychotic episodes as well, can't it, cannabis, and especially if you're getting some of the heavier strains of it, I think it can be very bad for you if you're
well, that's taking... in the unregulated markets, you don't know what you're giving your child. I recently spoke to a family, again, they used cannabis for their child that had cancer. It's Dick G, and that really improved. It didn't save him. He died 18 months ago, but it extended his life. But they didn't know what they were giving. They were winging it. They said it themselves. They said, we didn't really know what we were doing. We didn't know how much THC we were giving him. There's so many unknowns. All we know that he did, you know, he was going to school. He had a tumour. At that point, he should have been disabled.
Yeah.
And he's doing really, really well. But they even they're saying that should have been under clinical oversight. Responsibility of a parent.
Yeah, and when I've discussed this on the podcast before, apparently that if you're going into the sort of illegal market, they harvest the marijuana early, too early, because they obviously want to get into the marketplace quickly, and that's where you get the problems with it if you haven't let it mature enough, the leaf, apparently. Is that correct? It makes it more potent.
I'd say on the early days, if they're harvesting it early, you're not getting as much THC. That's where the dryer and the curing process can help increase the THC.
Right.
But yeah, again, this is, as a medicine, it should be done under proper conditions. Things.
So do you think they're worried that we're going to go the way of America? So America starts handing out medical marijuana, and then basically it's just legalized there now, isn't it? Because everyone gets a card saying they need it, and then they just decided to, as far as I can work, I don't know, I haven't been to America for a while, but as far as I can work out, a lot of the states now, you just walk in and buy anything under the guise of medical marijuana,
quite a few
gummy
states.
Bears and everything.
It is a concern in the UK. There are, it has been spoken about with politicians and with clinicians that medical cannabis is going to lead to legalization, like it has in similar other countries. The UK has an opportunity to get it right, though.
Is that a problem?
No, I think generally, you know, legalization should happen in the drug reform aspect. There is a particular issue in our fight, especially we've seen this in Canada, where those producing cannabis in regulated industries, then legalization has come and they've turned their attention to that it's more profitable. You've got less regulation. It's not a pharmaceutical medicine, if that makes sense. So then the research hasn't happened because of legalization. So it's actually had a knock-on effect. And that's impacted patients like my son, Charlie, and those that, with chronic conditions where they need it under clinical oversight. So there has been a negative impact because of legalization. So I think here in the UK, at the point that we're at the moment, we have an opportunity to do it slightly differently. And it's not that we're up against legalization, but let's sort out those with chronic conditions who are really desperately in need of cannabis, where it can change their life under clinical oversight through the NHS, and then allow legalization to happen. That's my view. Anyway.
Yeah, I suppose. It's a tough one, isn't it? It's a minefield out there, how we go forward. But we have to go forward, but how we go forward. Always at the back of my mind is, it's like, will it work with alcohol? That's legal, and that seems to be working.
So, alcohol's much more harmful.
Much more harmful, yeah. Exactly right, yeah. As I say, it's such a minefield. Which way we go with this? But I just think, what would you want to happen? How would you see it? What do you think should happen?
I think right now, with the families that we're working with and what I'm seeing and how desperate families are, you know, they are going to go to every avenue to try and support their child and protect their child. I feel the NHS or the British Paediatric Neurology Association should be supporting families. They should be accepting, okay, they are going to go to the guy down the pub. I'm not going to turn my back on them. I'm going to bring that child under my care. I'm going to prescribe them an unlicensed cannabis medicine, but we know that's safe. And then start looking towards clinical trials. I think that's the way to the NHS access.
The few politicians I've spoken to about drug reform, and this isn't cannabis, by the way, this is just drug reform totally, they've said to me the appetite isn't there for the electorate. We're still under the belief that drugs are really harmful and bad for the messages that the media, we're to blame, probably us, the media, the politicians. None of us are actually sitting down and having proper conversations about this, so it's left to me and you doing it on a podcast rather than it hitting the news. So, you know, something will happen and one of the major politicians will go, yes, we're gonna be strong on drug crime or something, and it's like, let's just talk about it rather than just all that shit all the time that they have to come up with. And the thing which disappoints me most, I think, is through doing this podcast and through some of my own experiences, things like family law as an experience I've had, and drug reform and various other things, we always think in this country that we're ahead of the field. You know, we're the pioneers. That's what we're told constantly. It turns out that we're lagging behind in bloody everything. I mean, if you look at education, there's so many more countries who are doing better than us. Our NHS, which we all bloody love, is behind other NHSs or other health services. You know, drug reform, we're behind on it. Many things we're behind on. And I think as the population of the country, we've got to start blaming ourselves. We're too bloody miserable and angry, and we've got to start going, let's get the politicians to have some conversations. I'm just going to tell you a little thing, by the way. I look back at Question Time not so long ago. It was ages ago, the 80s. I looked at 80s Question Time, And they're having a conversation, not question time, but prime minister's questions. And they're having conversations. They're still making the stupid noises, but a lot more subtly. But they're having debates and explaining policies and then arguing it. Now we've just got a load of bunch of frustrating people just do catchphrases. We are proud of what we achieved in the and we're not getting anywhere. Because so if someone stood up in, sorry, I'm doing a rant now. This is more of a monologue than a question. But if someone now stood up in the House of Parliament and said, Rishi, can we discuss, you know, drugs and, you know, medical cannabis? You're never going to get an answer. There's not a discussion happening there. It's a load of people going, whoa, 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 at each other. And there'll never be a discussion. It's like, where did the discussion happen now? It's so frustrating that we can't see our because we know for a fact drug reform would change society and the world. Why aren't they discussing it in that bloody place? It's an absolute joke. And I've interviewed so many politicians and people around politics who say, isn't it wonderful that we're holding the Prime Minister accountable? You're not. Yeah. You're just all shouting at each other. Nothing is getting done. Anyway, sorry about the rant. But I'm just saying, well, you know, as Britain, we always think that we lead the way with these things. We are so far behind on so many issues at the moment because we've got a rotten political environment at the moment.
With cannabis, Israel have been leading the way for decades. You know, they're 30, 40 years ahead in their research in cannabis. They're now looking at the endocannabinoid system and genetics, you know. Do our genetics have an impact on our endocannabinoid system and how cannabis can help that and help prevent diseases, prevent cancers? And we're not even, you know, we haven't even got to the point where we're prescribing it properly. I completely agree. It's a mess. I do feel there's a social economic argument to this as well. If with reform, you know, there's an industry here that cannabis could bring jobs, it could bring tax. You know, it could bring a huge amount of money into the UK and exports as well. When medicines are licensed, we can export them like GW Pharma. But they're not listening. They're just politicians turning a blind eye to it and turning their back to it. You know, Hannah's got, she's lobbying at the moment for that side of it, for the business side, which will have an impact on health as well, a positive impact on health. So it's something that politicians really need to be grabbing. You know, grabbing some of them are listening, but the vast majority, especially the Conservative Party, are just not listening, which is so frustrating because time and time again, you know, I've spoken to Matt Hancock several times face to face about this issue. Back in 2019, he promised that we'd have access to our medicines, and here we are today, and there I am watching him. I'm a celebrity.
Oh, just, how did that feel?
Hannah tweeted a picture of him. We filmed him promising us that this medicine would be available to our children.
And he got paid $400,000, didn't he, for doing that?
And now
well.
He's just been paid $400,000, yeah. So it's just, and he's just apparently started up his own charity for neurodiverse children, which is even more of an insult given that, you know, the situation our children are in. It is incredibly frustrating. But we'll never stop. We will always keep fighting for our children, campaigning, going to government, and
That's another problem with governments, I think, and politicians at the moment. And again, we need to start blaming ourselves on this. Is the fact that if they lie, I don't think every politician should know everything about everything. That's a fact. And I think if you politician turns up, health secretary turns up on TV and they start talking about the transport system, he should say, "I don't know. I do the health." Go and get the transport guy secretary in here if you want to talk about that. But the media's a lot to blame on this because they just all push back and lie all the time because they've got to cover their asses constantly because otherwise they don't know. They don't know what's going on in transport. It's like, of course I don't. I work in health and that's a kind of full-time job. But when they do lie, like, you know, Boris on numerous occasions lied that you know, I'm not anti-Tories here, by the way. I don't have an allegiance to any party. But when someone does lie or Hancock lies or whoever lies, there should be consequences because you're serving the public. It should be immediate. Like, it shouldn't be them resigning. It should be immediately, no, you're fired because you lied to the public and you're not allowed to do that in politics. You're fired and you're not allowed to work in the civil service again. You know, that's it, gone. But we allow it. So we just got none of us have any faith left in them at all.
I think we've just come immune to that. I think it's so commonplace that it's just accepted. It's almost expected of a politician.
Well, I'm politically homeless, and I have so much apathy for them. I used to tune into Question Time, and I used to tune into PMQs as well. I don't bother with any of it now because I just don't believe any of it. And I think everyone's the same. I think we've all got apathy for them all and stuff. So it's so hard. And every now and then, and there are some very good MPs. I've met them, by the way, and you must have met a load. Very, very good MPs, but the game at the moment doesn't work. So to try and get this stuff through, if you're in a country like possibly Finland or somewhere, they'd be discussing it constantly, going, what should we do? You know, should we be doing this? Because they like to move forward. But, you know, we're stuck in a stupid power battle between two parties, aren't we? And then three now because SNP in Scotland. And that's where we're at. And I'm not sure how we're going to move out of there either, which is really frustrating. Sorry, it's turned into a political...
Yeah, no,
But you get to meet them, and I, you know, so I haven't met
them
for
a while.
There are some
really good MPs who are really supportive, but the vast majority, you know, come from Eton. It feels like they're disconnected. They're not. I'd love to see more ordinary people that have experienced, you know, the ins and outs of life and just, you know, going through normal education and having a normal job and, you know, someone that's within the NHS and experiences all the troubles. So then go into politics and become the health secretary.
Exactly.
That's what I feel.
All agree. Yeah, I think we all agree with that. And what also, my final rant here, is all those bloody politicians all admit to taking cocaine, right? Oh, yeah, I've probably had a line of cocaine here or there. Well, why you should be arrested then? Do you know what I mean? It's like, if you're keeping this shit illegal and you're admitting it in a public space, then why isn't someone coming? Why aren't the police knocking at their door going, hold on a second, you're not allowed to do that. That's illegal. You know, they're allowed to do that. I find the whole thing so maddening that, you know, and then when you speak to people who are actually involved in, this is the problem is, you know, politicians now, professional politicians, they don't come from the background. So you've got a health secretary. I don't know about Matt Hancock's background, but I don't assume he has anything to do with health. And yet he's suddenly the health secretary. Do you know his background? What's he come? Do you know where he comes from?
I've got no idea. No. But I do, from what I know, what little I know about it, it's predominantly the advice behind the scenes. They're the ones that are advising the politicians. So obviously an MP, you can't go from transport, education and health and be an expert in all them areas. They are very reliant on the advisors who don't change, and they are essentially the experts in that industry.
Well, I had a chat, and it might have changed a lot because this is a few years ago. I had a chat with a spin doctor, and I asked him what the chances are of getting drug reform. He said there's no appetite for it because it doesn't, not under
this government.
And he said it won't happen until the public change their opinions. Hopefully things like this will help. And he was the one who helped get he wasn't the person, but he said he was around when gay marriage was around, and he said there was a tipping point where suddenly everybody was in favor of it. And so, I mean, I think the Tory party in the end got are the ones who brought gay marriage through, which is, you know, probably surprising, but they were the ones who decided to get it through. And it's like when the public are swayed enough, then the politicians will jump on because they believe it's a cause worth
exactly
fighting
what,
for. Cause it, yeah.
Well, that happened for cannabis. You know, it was Hannah's campaign. The public supported it. The media really supported it. And that pressure pushed the government to make a decision. And, you know, it was a great decision. They've done the right thing. Since then, they've just left it to the NHS to kind of guide it, and nothing has changed. You know, there's only been 3 NHS prescriptions in 4 years, with only 60 children left in the private sector. And, you know, there's 30,000 children suffering with refractory epilepsy. That's hundreds of seizures, or potentially hundreds of seizures every single day. So there's a massive cohort of children suffering that have tried and exhausted everything, and cannabis is there potentially to help them. and it's just not accessible.
So Matt, people like you and Hannah are bloody heroes, aren't you? Because you're going the extra yard, but obviously it's a very sad situation for you, though. It must be giving your life a lot of purpose. You must be quite driven towards trying to, because you must see a lot of children who need this. So you must be, you know, driven towards helping.
I'm just looking to Charlie's future. So, you know, he's always going to be severely disabled. He's not going to be able to make decisions for himself. He's going to require care. So when I go, who's going to look after him and how is he going to access these medicines himself? That's why we're fighting for NHS access. So when he's in under care and social services, which will happen one day, you know, I want to know that he's safe, that he's well, that he's going to continue living the best life that he can with these medicines. That at this point, that's not going to happen. You know, he's in the private sector. We're not going to be able to have a social services person go to your local guy down the pub and get, you know, that's not going to happen. So it's for his future, but it's for everyone else's future as well. It's just hope. It's, you know, it's another option out there when there's very few other options available.
Matt, tell the listener how they can find out more about this if they might have a child or themselves feel like cannabis might help them, and how they can also follow you to see if they can help at all with trying to raise awareness.
So firstly, if you're a clinician, neurologist or consultant or anyone in the medical world interested in cannabis, please go to the Medical Cannabis Clinician Society. They're a UK-based community interest company. They've got over 300 clinicians already, so it's a community of clinicians talking to one another with the research and the evidence base there. From that perspective, go there. But if you're a parent or a patient looking to understand more cannabis, medcansupport.co.uk, that's our organisation. We have a website. There's a huge amount of information on there. We have previous webinars with international clinicians, with researchers, academics, discussing cannabis for all sorts of, predominantly epilepsy, but in cancers as well. We're on Instagram, so we can support on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. So just follow our social media pages, just retweet. Hannah Deacon has her petition as well, so that's on change.org. That has over 600,000 signatures now. So if anyone can share that, sign it. If we can get to 1 million, then we can start talking about it in government again. So that's something we're pushing. And also Medcan Support, we have a crowdfunder at the moment and trying to raise money. We're looking to convert to a charity. So at the moment, we're a community interest company and raising funds to do that. So just give us a follow.
Matt, thanks so much. And I'll put those all on the description if you want to go.
Yeah,
that'd
be amazing.
You can have a look there. Thanks so much for joining me, Star. I'm really sorry I got a bit ranty there. Not very professional of me, but I'm getting so fed up of it all. And I suppose the older I get, the more tired I'm getting of our political environment we're living in. It's like, Jesus fucking Christ. How much money are those, you know, those drug companies spending on researching the latest bloody drug for depression or whatever it is to make money out of? And meanwhile, no one's looking at the stuff that we know could help people with the psilocybin, the LSD, the cannabis, the ketamine, the MDMA, yep, the da-da-da-da-da-da, all been made illegal because people use them recreationally.
That's the damage prohibition's had, though, over all these 50, 60, 70 years of prohibition. That's now impacting access now. That stigma, it shows that we've gone down the wrong path. It's had a massive impact.
I'll leave you on this, Matt, on my WhatsApp group with some of my mates. I was talking about this the other day, and one of my mates goes, Tim, please stop going for drug reform. I don't want my son to take it. I thought, his son, by the way, is in secondary school. He's got a few years left. He's about to go to university. And I was thinking, mate, and especially as knowing the background of my friend, he wasn't the cleanest of people. And I'm going, holy shit, what? You think that your son is not going to be able to buy this shit out there? It's easier than ever. Do you know what I mean? At least let it be regulated. Oh, my God, the stupidity of it all. But there you go. It is what it is.
Extremely easily accessible. I agree. We need reform.
Matt, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.